Stillman and Company is delivered by TriStar Moving. TriStar Movers with five-star service. We're live from the Hillside Medical Game Studios, and we're streaming live on Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook Live. Our video streaming is brought to you by the law offices of Amanda Gentry. Chad Withrow joins us now, Outkick 360. Chad, we were just chatting about the Deshaun Watson hearing that just wrapped up and how this has a snowball effect with not just the Browns, but with Baker Mayfield as well. And then you're also bringing in the Carolina Panthers or the Seattle Seahawks or teams that could potentially be interested in Baker Mayfield. And this whole thing is just a big old mess. So my question to you is, who is quarterbacking the Browns next season?
Well, that's a great question. It's not going to be Baker Mayfield. I probably going to have a one-year suspension. Probably Jacoby Brissett is going to be quarterback in the Browns. Here's something we talked about a little bit on our show today that got me thinking about some red flags with Deshaun Watson that's completely separate of the red flags of the, 24 women who are accusing him of wrongdoing. The red flags on Deshaun Watson, the competitor, okay? He had to be convinced to go to Cleveland with a guaranteed contract. Cleveland had to give him guaranteed money, even if he suspended this year, to get full salary in order to play in Cleveland. Cleveland was the best team from a roster standpoint on his list of suitors because, it was Atlanta, Miami, Carolina.
You know,
other teams are on there. Yeah, are not good right now compared to Cleveland, whose roster is good. If this guy ultimately all he wants to do is win and win a Super Bowl, the fact that he wasn't going to go to Cleveland because of what? It's cold? It's windy? That he had to be convinced to come back to the negotiating table and tell his agents that he would go there only with a guaranteed contract? That's a red flag to me. On the flip side of that, say what you want about Baker Mayfield, and clearly, he rubbed some people the wrong way, and they didn't like him. Not all of his teammates liked him in Cleveland. Here's a guy who fought through an injury and went out there and played, and it was to his own detriment. He probably shouldn't have played. It probably hurt his ability to go get a contract or even come back with Cleveland because he tried to push through injury to help his team. Deshaun Watson sits out a year ago. He did before all the allegations because he didn't like the direction of the Texans. Continued to do so even though he was eligible to play. We had David Coley in studio on Monday. He said, he tried to talk him into playing, and that conversation didn't last too long. And he had to be convinced to go to the best team on his list only because they came back and gave him everything he wanted. He had crossed them off, even though they were the team most capable of getting to a Super Bowl. Those are some red flags for Deshaun Watson, the player, on top of the other obvious red flags.
But it's not like I look at Cleveland as being some Super Bowl contender. I mean, they play in a difficult division, at least this season, with Baltimore and Cincinnati. And this is such a difficult AFC, and I do not think that if there's a Super Bowl table, I don't think that Cleveland has a seat at it. And yeah, to your point, Carolina and in Atlanta, those aren't teams that are necessarily equipped to win the Super Bowl right now either. But I don't look at Cleveland as being some dark horse in the AFC.
Well, they were, a bad quarter away from going to the AFC Championship game with Baker Mayfield just 2 years ago. Right, we're a year removed from that happening. And people can say what they want about Baker Mayfield, but now put Deshaun Watson from a talent standpoint on that roster, that roster is good. I mean, you're right, it is a tough division. With Cincinnati and Baltimore, and I'm not saying that I'm putting them at the top of the list of, here are the four or five Super Bowl contenders this year, but my point is, that's a playoff team. That is a playoff roster. I really feel that way about Cleveland. And I look around and see, the rest of that team, or the rest of the teams on his list, those teams are not close to the Super Bowl. I don't think they're very close to the playoffs when you look up and down those teams. So, again, I think Deshaun Watson is a terrific player. When he's healthy and he's playing and he's into it, he's a top-five quarterback in the league. But that's just something that jumped out to me about Deshaun Watson, the competitor, that would give me a little bit of pause if I'm a Browns fan.
I think that's a fair point, and honestly something that I haven't looked into. But Chad Withrow is with us, Outkick 360. And this is a discussion that Jared and I have had. But I wonder, let's say it is a year suspension, which I think is probably the most likely scenario for Deshaun Watson. A year suspension, he's back in 2023. That'll be 2 years since Deshaun Watson had a full season starting in the NFL. Can he still be good after 2 years of not competing in the NFL?
Yeah, I think he can. I think Michael Vick proves that. You know, he was gone, I want to say, 2 or 3 years when he went to prison.
Yeah, and to that point, that's prison versus not being in prison. So it's a different scenario there.
They let you exercise in prison, Caroline, but I don't think you're getting quite the reps.
I don't think you have quarterback gurus in prison. Maybe you do.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some athletic guys, but I don't know how many guys are out there throwing and running routes with you.
Yeah, I've never been, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I've seen a lot of movies and television shows about prison.
Yeah, I've seen The Longest Yard.
That's our knowledge right now. So we're experts on prison, is what we're trying to tell everyone. you're not getting the football-specific work that you need in prison, but you can stay in shape. With Deshaun Watson, I mean, he can do whatever he wants, you know, in terms of workouts and everything else. So I don't think that's going to be a big issue. There's going to be some rust to knock off for sure, but I don't think it derails his career or anything. I think he can come back and be a top-10 quarterback in the league right away and work his way back into being a top-5 quarterback pretty quickly, even if he's out 2 years.
Chad Witherow is with us, Outkick 360. Chad, you say your prediction for the starting quarterback in 2022 for the Browns is Jacoby Brissett. And I think a lot of Titans fans might look at that and almost feel a little bit of relief. But I look at that as potentially being a bad thing for the Titans because I look at the Browns' schedule this year. They play the Patriots. They play the Chargers. They play the Browns. They play the Bills. They play the Bengals. They play the Ravens. They play really difficult teams on their schedule, teams that are slated to be at the top of the AFC. So if Jacoby Brissett is quarterbacking the Browns, then those teams could look at the Browns game as an automatic win, whereas with Deshaun or with Baker, it'd be a little bit more competitive. So I would say this is almost a bad thing for the Titans, that the Browns could potentially have Jacoby Brissett quarterbacking that team and be a less competitive team against these much more stacked rosters in the AFC.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, you go into it and you immediately think, okay, well, that's one more AFC team that's not going to be a factor in the playoff race, so that's good for the Titans. But then, yes, you know, you see the common opponents and everything else, and you get to the season, and, you know, it's always amazing who you're rooting for to help your team as the year goes on. And a lot of times it flips, right? You know, there's one game you think, man, we're going to this team to do well or this team to upset this one. Then you get to the season, and that team suddenly in contention for a playoff spot you're looking for, and you're rooting for the opposite team going into that game. So, I mean, look, that's really playing chess when you look at it, you know, that far out with who you want quarterbacking the Browns for the Titans, to go to the Titans. Here's a more interesting thing for me on the Titans-Browns connection, and I thought about this originally, but then I stopped thinking about it when the Titans drafted Malik Willis in the third round. We had Jordan Schultz on yesterday, who's an NFL reporter and does a great job with his podcast also. He broke the Rob Gronkowski retirement story. But we asked him about Baker Mayfield, like you asked me, Caroline, to start, and he said, why not the Titans for Baker Mayfield? And he kind of laughed, and he said, I know they just drafted a quarterback, but seriously, if they did not draft Malik Willis, if he wasn't there in the third round, he said, I fully expect, knowing John Robinson, he would be making a move for Baker Mayfield right now to back up Ryan Tannehill as the backup option in Nashville. And that really got my brain running when I heard that. And I'm thinking, you know, it's not crazy because it's kind of what they did with Ryan Tannehill and Marcus Mariota, right? They brought in a guy with starting experience that didn't work at the very end of his tenure with his previous spot, and he came in. And he was a great backup. I mean, Baker Mayfield's a great backup for someone. I think we'd all agree. But it's a great insurance plan, too, if it doesn't work out with Ryan Tannehill. So made me think, well, it's not going to happen now with Malik Willis on the roster, but wouldn't that be something?
Chad Witherow is with us, brought to you by Apple Collision Centers, online at applecollisioncenters.com. To your point, Chad, and it's a really interesting point to bring up, but why does Malik Willis throw a hitch in all of this? Because, I mean, I would say that right now, my prediction is for the Titans to carry 3 quarterbacks on game day. Let's say, you know, you ditch Logan Woodside, you bring in Baker Mayfield. I don't think anyone expects Malik Willis to start or even play this season. So what about Malik Willis would inhibit the Titans from going out and getting Baker Mayfield as their backup?
Well, you're speaking my love language right now, saying what you did about Logan Woodside, because I just don't get it. I hope Logan Woodside is not listening right now, but I get so tired of, well, they just love him. He really knows the system. He's a great locker room guy. If Logan Woodside had to start for the Tennessee Titans, there is a 0.0% chance they could win in the NFL. If you have a good backup in the NFL, here's the way I rate a good backup. If you are on a good football team that is a playoff team, I'm not talking about a 14-2 type team. I'm talking about, you know, or I guess another 17 games, so 14-3. I'm talking about 11-6 type team, you know, 12-5 that's going to get to the playoffs. Your backup quarterback, if he had to start four consecutive games, can get you to 500 over those games. That is a really good backup quarterback situation in the NFL. Who believes that Logan Woodside would win a single game over four if he had to start for the Tennessee Titans? And I think even the most diehard, staunch Titans fan would tell you they don't believe he could win a game in the NFL. And I don't get it. I mean, I think it's great that the guy knows the system. Okay, how many people could you find that can learn the system and be a good locker room guy as a backup quarterback, but also could not win you a game if you had to? That's Logan Woodside to me. So, look, you're probably asking the wrong person because I'm way too into that plan. I would love to have Baker Mayfield in Nashville as a backup quarterback. I'd love it if there was a situation where Malik Willis could learn from both Ryan Tannehill and Baker Mayfield, and you had those two options at the top. I just don't see that happening.
You know, we have a term on this show. We say anti-Tannites for me and Jared in the anti-Tannehill club, but I think that you reside more so in the anti-Loganite group.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
I think that's fair. I'm awfully worked up over the backup over here, Chad.
It's probably too much of a mouthful, but I am anti any backup quarterback that I hear from people who cover the team or, you know, GMs and coaches that, you know, he's a great locker room guy. We really like him. He really knows the system. Well, great. You know, the assistant quality control quarterback coach at these places, they know the system well, too. Doesn't mean they should be the backup quarterback. And I hear that way too much about Logan Woodside.
615-737-1025 is our phone number. Chad Withrow is with us, Outkick 360. An absolute bombshell dropped on college football yesterday. USC and UCLA will enter the Big Ten next year. What does that mean for the future of college football, for the future of the SEC, for the future of the college football playoff? Everything is up in the air. We'll get into that with Chad Withrow coming up next. Caroline Fenton, Adam Vingenen for Jared Stillman. It's Stillman and Company on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Stillman and Company, 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Chad Withrow is with us. Chad Withrow brought to you by Apple Collision Centers, online at applecollisioncenters.com. Chad, first of all, someone tell Paul Kaharsky to log out of Twitter. Someone tell Paul to put his phone away. But second of all, a huge bombshell dropped on college football. USC and UCLA were unanimously voted into the Big Ten. And I have a million questions, a million concerns, just a million thoughts rolling through my head. But what do you think this means for the future of college football?
Man, Paul stepped in it this week on your station. That was fun to follow. That's one of those where I just grab popcorn and sit back and don't comment on anything and just watch the fallout from it. Which,
that's probably the best approach. That's usually what I do with PK's Twitter.
I don't know if Adam can hear me right now, but Adam, congratulations. That means the beacon of journalism amongst the Predators community. But in all seriousness, you really did do a great job. But that was fun to follow. Anyway, so on to college football. Here's where it's going. I think it's going to 2 24-team super conferences. I don't think we're done. I think we're going to get more news pretty quickly on some of this. I think you would be foolish if you are a team in the ACC or Big 12 or Pac-12 that's not angling to get to the Big Ten or the SEC. I think the SEC, you know, I tweeted this out, that what's the counter from the SEC to the Big Ten? And people were responding and saying, well, they don't need a counter because now they're just even, right? You know, the SEC took Texas and Oklahoma, and now the Big Ten countered with USC and UCLA, so it can be done. And I'm thinking, this thing isn't done. The SEC is not going to stop until they are far superior to the Big Ten. So there's going to be a counter move by the SEC. This is just going to continue until we're looking at probably a two conference of 24 teams, 48-team college football super conference that's going to look an awful lot like the AFC versus the NFC in a Super Bowl at the end of the year, where the Big Ten champion will play the SEC champion, and that will decide the college football national champion. I think that's where all of this ends. How quickly do we get there? I don't know. My guess is probably in the next 5 to 10 years. That's what we're going to see.
Yeah, that's actually the exact comparison that I've been using, is college football will turn into the NFL, not just in terms of being more of a commercial product, but because it'll be the AFC and the NFC, and you'll have an NFL-style playoff coming down the pipe. But you mentioned the timeline, and I think that's so spot on, because it's going to happen sooner rather than later. I mean, realignment, conference realignment, is not something that's new to college football. I mean, it happens all the time. But the rate at which it's happening right now is rapid. And it's not just Louisville going to the ACC, and it's not just small moves here and there. I mean, you're talking about the biggest programs and the biggest moneymakers in college football joining already massive conferences. And I think that it is going to happen, like, to your point, sooner rather than later. But to your point about the massive super conferences, we've been talking about this today, and I think it's an intriguing topic of where does that leave some of the smaller teams, or more so to that point, less competitive teams in Vanderbilt, and on the Big Ten side of things, Northwestern and Indiana. Those aren't competitive football teams. So where do these teams lie in the super conferences?
I mean, I think they lie in the Big Ten and the SEC. I don't think there's any chance that those schools get voted off the island because they've been on it for so long. Here's the luckiest two programs in America are Rutgers and Maryland, who joined the Big Ten in 2014. Think about Rutgers, you know, who's contributed nothing to college football in the last 50 years.
To make the same argument about Missouri.
Significance. Yeah, well, who do they contribute? The McCourty twins and Logan Ryan, right? Missouri's another great one, right? That they found they A&M was going to be okay, but Missouri got into that, you know, safe boat, and they are just sailing on the ocean of success and prosperity because they jumped in with the SEC. Same for Rutgers and Maryland. Now, look, Vandy, they offer nothing from a football perspective to the SEC. Nothing. Not only that, they have a tendency to take large checks and do nothing with it, and not invest it back into athletics, and certainly not into football, which has been a big contention of mine. But they're a charter member of the SEC. I mean, they're not going anywhere. I don't think any of those other programs are going anywhere either. They're just really fortunate that they're going to get a chance to stick around. Now, the really fascinating one is what happens to Duke? What happens to Wake Forest? You know, what happens to some of these programs that don't offer a lot from a football perspective in the ACC or the Pac-12, or the Big 12 right now, when this game of musical chairs is done and the music stops? I fear for those programs, they're not going to have a seat when the music stops.
And to your point about Greg Schiano, he's probably looking at Tennessee fans, not thinking that he'd get the last laugh, but look at him. He's the one of the founding members of the Super Conference in the Big Ten. But to your point about Duke and Wake Forest and some of these less competitive teams in the ACC or the Pac-12, or even I look at the Big 12 as well, and their new realignment, you know, bringing in BYU or UCF seems so much less significant now because, to your point, those teams will not have a permanent home in this incredibly competitive Super Conference that seems inevitable to come. So I almost look at this like it's going to be an expansion of two super conferences, and it's almost going to be a different division of college football. It seems to me that they're going to have to compete for a different national championship because these two columns or these two pillars of college football will be so drastically different.
Yeah, first off, stop it on Greg Schiano. There is nothing better about being the Rutgers head football coach. That's better than being the Tennessee head football coach. And last I checked, Tennessee is still in the SEC and not at risk of being kicked out of the SEC. So I would still rather be in the SEC than the Big Ten, even after this movement. But you're spot on what's going to happen to the leftovers, essentially. You know, Washington State, Oregon State, Cal, Wake Forest, Duke, Syracuse possibly. You know, go down the list of ACC, Big 12, Pac-12 schools that don't get in that. What I see it as a 48-team mega conference that consists of 24 Big Ten schools, 24 SEC schools. Those that don't find their way into those two conferences, I mean, they're going to keep playing football, but is it some sort of like what you see with the group of five now, where we know the college football playoff is going to expand? So let's go with the college football playoff going to 16 teams, let's say, just for the purposes of this mental exercise. Well, if that happens, I'm willing to bet 14 of them will be Big Ten or SEC in this new college football reality. So there's two outside spots for the other conferences that are left playing and those other schools. I mean, I think that's probably realistic that they kind of go to a level of football that you see now with most group of five teams where they're playing competitive football. They're going to play some of the big boys on their schedule. But for the most part, you know, MTSU's not playing the same sport as Alabama, right? It's not the same thing. Even though they're both FCS teams, it's two different levels. I think that those teams we just mentioned, the leftovers of those conferences, the big conferences now, the Power Five, they go into that next level down mode.
Chad Withrow is with us, Outkick 360. And to your point about the two mega conferences, is that going to be the only scenario in which Notre Dame joins a conference? Where does all of this leave Notre Dame?
Notre Dame is in a really good spot because they are the bell of the ball right now. I mean, the Big Ten and the SEC would love to have Notre Dame. They offer a ton of financial value to the ACC now with their partnership and just scheduling the four or five games or how many they play against the ACC with that partnership brings a lot of television dollars and a lot of money to the ACC. They also make a lot of money as an independent right now, and they're not inclined to join a conference. They are eventually going to have to join a conference. They should join the Big Ten. I mean, that makes the most sense to me, and I think eventually they will join the Big Ten. But, man, oh, man, whoever gets Notre Dame, that is a huge coup. That is the most valuable football program that's left out there right now. That's not in the Big Ten or the SEC. I mean, we can go on the list. Oregon, Washington, you know, are being rumored. Florida State, Miami. I take Notre Dame over all of those. So they're in a really good spot.
Chad Withrow is with us, Outkick 360, and you mentioned Clemson, Florida State, because I think that Dabo is knocking on the door of the president of Clemson. I think that Florida State and Oregon, they're all doing the same thing, that they are all scrambling, trying to find their permanent home and their next move. So in your opinion, Chad, what do you think is the next domino to fall? Because there are a lot of intriguing moves that would make sense, either the Big Ten or the SEC for teams in the ACC and the Pac-12.
Yeah, I think the next move is going to be done by the SEC unless we buy these rumors, some reports out there about Oregon and Washington. I don't know if you saw it, but John Canzano, who's a big-time reporter in Oregon, is saying that, you know, lawmakers in those two states are trying to keep Oregon State, Washington State bound together. The way it's worded, that's not, well, they have to stay in the Pac-12. That's they need to be together. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, hey, Big Ten, take all of us. Along with you, you're going to do it. And to me, that's a move to shield Washington State and Oregon State from getting left behind. I think if that's not the next move, I think it is a Clemson, Florida State. You know, here's what makes the most sense to me, just right off the bat, geographically, culturally, everything. Clemson, Florida State, Miami, and either North Carolina or Virginia Tech joins the SEC. I think culturally, Virginia Tech fits better from a football standpoint. I think brand-wise, North Carolina has a lot more to offer. If you buy this academic superiority of the Big Ten argument, then North Carolina and Virginia will eventually join the Big Ten and not the SEC. I don't buy that. I think
that's a dumb argument.
Are on the mind of anyone, right? It's all about money right now, so I'm not buying that argument. If I had my pick, I would go SEC next move, and I think Miami, Florida State, Clemson, North Carolina, that's the play for the SEC.
And to your point about geography, I agree with you that Florida State, Clemson, Virginia Tech, those moves make so much more sense to the SEC geographically, culturally. But if this move from USC and UCLA to the Big Ten has told us anything, it's that nothing is off the table, that geography doesn't matter anymore, that culture doesn't matter anymore, because I don't even know how many players at USC and UCLA have even seen snow, much less played in it. So I can only imagine what that plane ride from USC to Lincoln, Nebraska is going to be like for these players. So I don't think that there's any sort of geographical or cultural aspect of this that's going to hold anything back. I think, to your point, it's all about money.
I totally agree. And look, we are only bound by the limits of our imagination right now. Mm-hmm. There are no geographic limits to what college sports could be and what these conferences are going to do. And you're right. I mean, you look at that map and you look how far away Los Angeles is from some of these places in the Big Ten, they prove that. But I'll be honest,
it's almost comical.
Outside of Notre Dame, if I'm the SEC, there's not a lot of brands left that I really covet. That's outside of Clemson, Florida. That's not already in your geographic footprint.
Florida State, Miami, I would argue, are the only ones left.
And again, that's all in your footprint. Mm-hmm. I can even go to Texas and say, I think Baylor, TCU are desirable. Well, that's in your footprint. I mean, there's an argument to be made for West Virginia from a cultural standpoint. I'd love to talk when Jerry gets back about Louisville, why Louisville's not discussed more with a move up. I think that makes sense for the SEC or the Big Ten, and they're kind of right there in that mid-range. I don't know. I mean, if you're this, what do you want to add? Colorado, Utah? I mean, these aren't brands that I'm dying to get a hold of if I'm the SEC. So it just falls in line where everything really outside of Notre Dame makes sense geographically and from a brand perspective of who the SEC would want and who they should go get next.
Chad, we appreciate you. We'll chat with you next week and have a good 4th of July weekend.
Always fun. Thanks, Caroline.
Appreciate it. You too. Chad Withrow, Outkick 360, joining us. Coming up next, I want to get to your thoughts on this college football playoff expansion, conference realignment, as well as some of your Preds thoughts as well. We'll get into your text. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. Caroline Fenton, Adam Vingan, and for Jared Stillman. It's Stillman and Company on 102.5 The Game. Tune in for Nashville Sounds Baseball tonight at 7:05 p.m. on 94.9 The Fan as the Sounds face the Indianapolis Indians, the AAA affiliate of the Pittsburgh Pirates, at First Horizon Park. Sounds Baseball 94.9 The Fan presented by 312 Pizza and Farm Bureau Health Plans. Adam, unless you have a thought?
To the phones.
To the phones! Adam in Portland is up next.
Miss Caroline, I've left y'all alone for the way. It's been so good. Y'all been good together.
Oh, thank you, Adam. I actually just told Ian at the break. I said I'm really looking forward to Adam's report card of the day, and I'm so happy that you've enjoyed it.
No, I would tell you if it was trash. I think y'all sound so good together.
I know you would tell us if it was trash.
100%. No, hey, so my only thought, because I don't care. If it's not the SEC, I don't really care about it. But I will say it's kind of, you know, the UCLA games and USC games, and they'll get that primetime game. It's like 10 p.m. start time. Mm-hmm. Is that still going to be a thing? Like, does Michigan State have to fly out there and play a game at 10 p.m. at night? Because that would be a huge advantage, right? If they go into the Big Ten and they have to play all these games super late because they're West Coast.
Yeah, thank you for your call, Adam. I think it depends on a couple of things. I think it depends on the network. So if you look at, let's say, ABC is carrying – hypothetically, a UCLA-Nebraska game. Well, that game is on at the same time no matter where you are in the world. So on the East Coast, that game's at 7. In Central Time, that game's at 6. So it completely depends on where you are. So, you know, in California, in LA, that game would be at 9 o'clock if my time zone is math is correct.
What time does it start Eastern Time?
7.
4.
Excuse me, 4. It would be at 4. So, yeah, so that would be how that turns out. It depends on the network. Now, the Pac-12 After Dark, I don't know how that's going to be handled. I really don't know. I think that's a fair question. Is that an advantage or a disadvantage? You know, I think we've all been there where we've traveled across time zones and you have a little bit of jet lag and, you know, you get tired a little bit earlier, you fall asleep a little bit later. I'm sure that's something that teams in the Big Ten will deal with, but I think that's a fair question to ask. We'll go back to your phones. Phone line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Scott texts in and says the next two dominoes to fall will be Clemson and Florida State to the SEC. I don't think that that's too far-fetched to think about. But where does that leave Miami? because I don't think that Miami is going to be left behind. If the Clemson and Florida State make a move, I don't think Miami is going to let themselves be left behind. I go back to the statement that the Pac-12 released yesterday, and they said that they were surprised and saddened by this move. And I think that's totally a disservice that the Pac-12 did to itself by saying that they were surprised. Because if the Pac-12 wasn't on top of this, then that's on their own wrongdoing. And I don't feel bad for them if they lose business for it, because that was their own oversight of, you know, the boxes they need to check as a business. I think Miami's doing the same thing. Miami is a strong enough football program to understand that they're in a very vulnerable position. I think Miami's probably reaching out to the Florida States and the Clemsons of the ACC and saying, okay, where do we go next? So I think Clemson and Florida State are very probable moves to the SEC. I just wonder where that leaves Miami as well.
Miami is not as much of a brand as it used to be. I mean,
it's not the same as the U days.
No, it's not. But it's still a very popular school. So, you know, Miami moving to the SEC, I don't think would have the same. It wouldn't pack the same punch, you know, as it would have 10, 15 years ago, you know, or something like that. But, you know, Clemson is an SEC school masquerading in the ACC. Or is an ACC school masquerading? I don't know. Either way.
ACC school masquerading is the SEC. It's an SEC school with an easier schedule.
Yes. I mean, Clemson is perfect for the SEC in terms of the level of competition, the culture, the geographic location. It makes a lot of sense. Clemson would fit, you know, perfectly within the confines of the SEC, as would Florida State and, I guess, Miami. But yeah, you know, I wonder if Miami and Florida State are package deals at this point. You know, I don't see Miami in the Big Ten being a fit, but that's just me.
But also, I didn't see UCLA being a fit in the Big
Ten.
Yeah,
that's true.
So, yeah, that tradition is out the window. Will from Nashville texts in and says, there's zero chance that Vanderbilt leaves the SEC. They're a baseball team has given the SEC another two national championships in a major sport over the last 6 years. I hear you. And Vanderbilt's baseball program is elite. Yes, I understand that. These are not moves that are driven by college baseball. These are moves where college baseball and basketball and track and swimming and all of the other sports just have to follow. Because baseball doesn't make a lot of money. There are very few college baseball programs that are actually revenue-generating programs. I believe Vanderbilt is one of them. But even if they do create revenue, it's a very, very low number. I believe that Vanderbilt baseball is at the top of college baseball, but their revenue is around $4 to $5 million. No, that's not nothing, but compared to college football, I mean, that could be what you pay a cupcake to come play you for homecoming. Mm-hmm. So I hear you, but this is not a move that's motivated by college baseball whatsoever.
I'm sorry. I am very interested in seeing how this affects college basketball. I mean, we've been focusing mostly on college football, obviously, but I'd be very curious to see how the idea of a super conference affects college basketball, affects automatic bids, conference championships, and how it affects the NCAA tournament. So that's not at the forefront of the conversation, but I personally am very interested to see how this affects that.
No, it's a fair thought, because conference champions, get an automatic bid to the NCAA tournament. So how does that turn out? I think it's a fair point. But Michael texts in with a Predators question and asks, does the fact that David Poile has traded high picks for such relatively unimpressive talent improve the odds of a big draft or RFA signing? Give up two Ryan Hartmans, a Jeremy Lozon, and a third to sign Matthew Tkachuk makes it feel like a pretty low price.
Well, you know, to the texter's point, you know, offer sheets, unfortunately, aren't used enough, you know, unless you're the Montreal Canadiens or Carolina Hurricanes, because they've kind of gone back and forth with that over the past couple of years. But, you know, I guess what the listener is asking is, if the Predators haven't had luck trading high draft picks for win in terms of, you know, win now moves, whether it was Ryan Hartman a few years ago — I wouldn't call Jeremy Lozano a win now move, but you know, would it make more sense to use that draft capital to tender an offer sheet, you know, to someone like Matthew Tkachuk or Patrick Laine or Marty Natchez or someone like that? Sure. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen. You know, David Poyle has been on the receiving end of two very high-profile offer sheets in his career. Shea Weber, of course, but also Scott Stevens when he was with the Washington Capitals. I think David Poyle has only actually executed one offer sheet, and that was, I think it was Dave Manson, like 30 years ago. I think he was a defenseman for the Oilers when David was with the Capitals. But David, as member of the, as an employee of the Predators, has never executed an offer sheet, and I would be surprised if it happened.
615-737-1025 is our phone number if you have a thought on that. But we are less than a week away from the NHL draft, and we're less than 2 weeks away from NHL free agency. So could we see the Predators make a big move over the long weekend? Maybe one that's the move that everyone's been waiting for. We'll get into that coming up next. Caroline Fenton, Adam Vingan, in for Jared Stillman. It's Stillman and Company on 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Stillman and Company, 102.5 and 106.3 The Game. Caroline Fenton, Adam Vingan, in for Jared Stillman. So my question to you, Adam, we've got a long weekend over 4th of July weekend. What are the odds that a Forsberg deal could get done over the next couple of days? Because I understand that these deals probably don't get done until they absolutely positively have to. But if the reporting is correct from Elliot Friedman on the Midday Show earlier this week that both sides have settled around $8.5 million per year, if both sides feel okay with that, what are the odds that it could get done this week? That on Tuesday by 2 o'clock, Forsberg will be a Predator.
That's a good question. My guess, this is just a guess, my guess is that something is announced by the end of next week. I think maybe leading into the draft. And again, this is a complete guess, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, they got to the draft and you know, they wanted to take care of that business before they focus on, you know, drafting players and you know, looking at other free agents. But you know, I think, you know, deadlines make deals. I think, as Corey Curtis said earlier, you know, if you lock them in a room, you know, they'd probably get it done. You know, David Poyle is a stubborn negotiator. JP Barry is, you know, also a stubborn negotiator. The best in the business tend to be that way because they want to do what's best for their teams or their clients. So, you know, a lot of headstrong people involved in this negotiation. But I think Jim Diamond is the only person I've heard on this station express any sort of pessimism about this deal not getting done.
Do you think that's warranted?
I mean, Jim is a smart guy, and I tend to believe the things that he says. I just have a hard time imagining this not getting done. So, you know, will you have it? Will you come on the air at 2 o'clock on Tuesday and have a contract to announce? My guess is no, but I wouldn't be surprised if it by the end of the week if you had something to talk about.
So 8.5 is the number that has been discussed, at least by Elliot Friedman, and I think that's a fair deal for both sides. If 8.5 is the starting point, do you think it's higher or lower? And do you think that trade protection is included?
I mean, I think I would trust Elliot if he says that it's going to come around 8.5. I think 8.5 seems like a solid enough number. It allows Phillip to be the highest paid forward on the team, the second highest paid player on the team. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do think trade protection is going to be a part of it. I don't know if it's going to be throughout the duration of the contract or only during part of the contract, but I would guess that he will have some form of trade protection at some point during his contract.
And when we talk about Forsberg, that's obviously the biggest move that the Predators, or at least Predators fans, are waiting for. But there are several other moves that could be made by the Predators over the weekend. Trades out of the team, trades back into the team. What do you think happens this weekend, or at least over the next week or so before the draft?
I'm not sure. I still think that Philip Forsberg dictates everything else. Now, when they sign him, they know how much cap space they have. They know that they have their top left winger. So I feel like a lot of this is going to be on hold until they get that done. So I'm not sure much will happen this weekend. You know, I think if you're a Predators fan, you can enjoy your holiday weekend without having to worry about it. Although, if I recall correctly, it was July 4th, 2012 that Ryan Suter announced he was signing with the Minnesota Wild. So anything can happen, I suppose. But my guess would be that it's a quiet weekend.
And, I mean, I have a ton of confidence. I said 90% a few weeks ago, confident that Forsberg was going to sign with the Predators. I remain at 90%. I think that's an overwhelming optimism. And to Jim Diamond's point, he isn't incredibly optimistic that this deal is going to get done. In what scenario would Forsberg not sign with the Predators?
I think if the – it's hard to say. I think if the Predators lowballed him, but I don't think they're going to.
I don't see that happening. With the cap space and the urgency to sign Philip Forsberg, I mean, they understand that losing him for nothing is detrimental to this team.
Right. I don't think trade protection is something that would completely torpedo the deal.
You don't?
No. I mean, I think it's going to be a part of it, but I don't think, like, you know, if he ended up with a modified no-trade clause, I don't think it would be the end of the world for him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really see unless the Predators were underselling him, I don't really see there being something that's going to really blow this up. Just, I think it's going to be Philip has to decide whether – you know, he might take less, you know, after taxes, you know, to play for a team that might have a better chance of winning in the immediate future.
And I'm with you that I do think that this deal has to include at least some sort of trade protection. I'm sure that was probably at the top of Forsberg's priority list, because I've mentioned it, that it's a double-edged sword that Forsberg wants to stay in Nashville because he wants to sign with the Predators, and he's going to do what it takes to sign with the Predators. However, he wants to do whatever it takes in order to stay in Nashville, because David Poile has a history of trading players away from Nashville. So I do believe that trade protection will at least be a part of this contract. How much, that's, you know, that's up in the air. But if Forsberg does receive some sort of trade protection, can David Poile continue to use the argument that the Predators don't offer trade protection? Because then you have, what, five players that now have trade protection in Duchesne, in Roman Josi, in Pecorine, and I'm forgetting somebody else. And then also with Forsberg. So I think that's a move that if you make it, that's you know, some power that David Poile is willing to flex in order to get this deal done. But I don't think that you can be a franchise that doesn't offer trade protection anymore when you do it four or five times.
Yeah, I think it's going to involve special cases. I mean, think about some of the players that have recently signed that didn't get trade protection. Matias Ekholm didn't get trade protection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mikael Granlund didn't get trade protection.
But those players aren't Philip Forsberg.
Right, but Matias Ekholm has been a member of this team for a very long time.
Yeah.
And had his name, you know, all up in the rumor mill, you know, two seasons ago, you know, before ultimately re-signing. So, you know, I think it's going to have to take special circumstances. You know, I don't think that every player that dons a Predators uniform is going to end up with a no movement clause or a modified no trade clause or a full no trade clause. But I, you know, David Poile is going to have to loosen his stance, to be sure. I mean, he already has, and he's going to have to continue to do so, most likely.
The biggest shocker that you think could come over this weekend?
The biggest shocker.
They've traded away Matthew Olivier for a fourth-round pick. That's not necessarily incredibly exciting. That's not going to, you know, make you jump out of your seat. What's a move that Poile could make? Let's say with the team that they already have, not necessarily bringing a player in, but a player that Poile could trade away that you think would be the biggest shocker this weekend?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure I see one. I think, you know, if the team –
I would say Soros. I don't think they're going to do it.
I think that would
be the biggest
that
shocker.
That would be a stunner, yes. Yeah. But, you know, realistically, I'm not sure I see one. I'm not sure there is a player that, you know, that qualifies, that I legitimately think is going to get traded, that would qualify as a shocker. My shocker of the weekend will be if Joey Chestnut doesn't win the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest.
That is a very important one, and we will be following that very, very closely. But that's going to do it for us today. Appreciate Adam Vingan stepping in while Jared Stillman is out. Everyone have a very safe and fun 4th of July weekend. And to get you set up for a weekend of patriotism, Chasing Checkers is up next, bringing down all things in NASCAR. Caroline Fenton, Adam Vingan, we will see y'all Tuesday at 2:00.